This is the Living Fearless Today podcast, a show that helps men like you and me who are struggling to get unstuck and overcome fear to live confidently and courageously. I'm your host and transformation coach, Mike Forrester, helping you create the change you want now. Join me as I interview men who've conquered their challenges and soared to success as they spill their secrets on how they live fearless today. Well, hello and welcome back, my friend. This week, I'm joined by Troy Carnes. And Troy, you know, you can look at other men and think that, man, that dude just has life nailed. But the problem is, we're looking at other people's lives from the outside. And when we're looking at our life, we know the behind the scenes. And it's one of those, you're comparing apples to oranges, but it's almost like you're comparing apples to watermelons. There's such a difference of what's portrayed on the outside. Man, Troy took the hard life, the hard decisions rather, and turned things around and then got hit by cancer on the other side. And it's one of those, none of us want to hear that. Dude, rather than just kind of pulling away, Troy doubled down and kept working at it and is now in a completely different place. And what I hope that you'll take from this is that, you know, even when those hard events, those hard situations come in life, it doesn't mean it's over. It doesn't mean that it's time to just, you know, throw up our hands. In fact, it's time to really solidify and stand in the moment. And we're going to see that from Troy and how he made the decision, he took action, and the results that followed. So excited to get into our conversation here today. Troy, how are you doing today, my friend?
I'm great today. It's been an amazing day so far.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm like, it's been not too long here that you just had your book launch. And so along with the book, you had the workbook as well. So, you know, that's a huge win because like so many other things, man, people will talk about stuff, but maybe not take action or take full action. And it's something you saw through to completion. So let's start out with, you know, what's the book and like what caused you to write the book?
Sure. Yeah. So book is the, I like to say it's the stories, the systems and the science that I used to keep myself sane and sober when I got my cancer diagnosis, you know, 98 days into my sobriety. And it's a third memoir and a third research and then a third, like, very actionable tactics that people could start folding into their lives every day. And it's really just like, it's what I do every day. And it's, I mean, these are just the exact tools that I have used now for, you know, what going on for, oh yeah, more than 4 years now. And I don't remember what date it was. But it's, yeah, it's really that. It's stories, science, and systems.
And so No Silver Bullet is the name of the book. And so let's dig into some of what you went through that then gave you the way to stay sane you talked about,
yeah,
you know, to really reclaim your life from a different perspective, right? So, man, you started out, you know, working in wine, moved into working with whiskey, transitioned there. Troy, from the outside, you know, you're traveling, you're, you know, getting to go to some of the best restaurants, man. Some of them that would just be like, dude, Troy, take me as your plus one, right? And so then you're also working with craft bartenders, some of the best that there are. But, you know, it's the risk of looking at somebody else's life from the outside is we're not seeing everything that's actually going on. Kind of take us behind the scenes of what was going on. And then how that led you to a place that wasn't, you know, like what everybody's seeing, like that castle in the sky that was actually, you know, more harmful than good for you.
Sure. I mean, even to highlight that a little bit, I got into that industry. I lived in Washington, D.C., and we were there because my wife got into grad school. And we would hang out with a bunch of her grad school friends, and they're like, you know, we're like in a cool city. Like, everybody wanted my job. You know, I was covering everything from, call it Boston to Miami. And yeah, my job was to essentially like, yeah, go to the coolest spots in town and convince them to buy my whiskey and then to use it, right? Sounds very glamorous, but there was a meme going around back then, and it was maybe like a 9-panel, and it was something like what my friends think I do, what my mom thinks I do, and they were all different. It's like what I actually do. And it's like what I actually do is get on planes hungover all the time. That reality was certainly not anything that you see on social media or that I talked about with my friends or family or anybody else I would talk to. I mean, you're on a plane, right? It's like, yeah, if you run into somebody you know, like very rare. So it was just me, right? That is the internal that you're talking about. And it was a lot of that. It was a lot about, yeah, getting on a plane hungover and trying to sleep for however long the flight lasted, because it was the most sleep I was going to get for a while. So yeah, that was the reality of that. But I hate to paint it sort of like all in a negative light, because I mean, it was amazing. I met friends that I'm still great friends with. I mean, I have a cool network across the country still that I made back then. And that's, you know, I mean, I started doing that, what, 15 years ago or something. And I still have really close friends that I made in that industry. And it's, you know, hospitality, you meet people, make friends and stuff like that. And yeah, it's, I'm not going to lie and say that it sucked to go, you know, hang out at the coolest places around. It was amazing. But yeah, there was just a whole other side to it as well, right? It's not all the highlight reels. It's also, you know, it's also the grim parts, or the, you know, the unglamorous or the difficult things that just don't get shared as much.
And I think that's the thing that we can miss, is looking at somebody else's life, you know, like I've alluded to and spoken to, is I'm seeing, Troy, your life from the outside, whereas I'm seeing the inside of my life. And a lot of times we will look more at the negative in our own life rather than what is going right. And so it's not really a fair comparison. Take the challenges that you're facing and confront them and take action on. And that was something you did. You know, you found yourself, I want to say you were a dad of two at the time.
Yeah.
You know, and you just kind of came home and your wife was like, this is not, you know, the way things are going. You talked about getting on the planes, you know, drunk, or hungover rather. And, you know, it's like, this is not working. And you then made a decision, you know, yeah, you're right. Take us through like kind of how that built up and then how you made that decision, because it's not an easy one to make, right?
Oh, no. I mean, that's a decision that I kicked down the road for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's easier to see that now than it was to see when I was in the middle of it. Ultimately, when I think about what led up to my decision to go to rehab, was, you know, that Pearl Jam song, Elderly Woman Behind the Small Counter, or Behind a Counter in a Small Town. I'm gonna, you know, it's like long title or whatever, but it makes me think about that, because it's fun and easy to have a job where you drink a lot and travel a lot when you don't have kids. So you and my girlfriend, then wife afterwards, and the amount of responsibilities that you have, they're fairly low compared to what I have now. And so the line in that song goes, I changed by not changing. And that just rings in the back of my mind all the time, because that's how, I mean, that perfectly encapsulates what happened to me, right? We move across the country from Washington, D.C. to Denver, which is where we grew up. So we came here to have a family. Kids come, responsibilities increase. Those things all change around me, but I didn't change with them. I stayed the same. And the things that I really admired about myself, or the values that I, you know, that I put label, I labeled myself as, you know, dependable and like all these things, those went away because I didn't change with all of the surroundings that were changing around me and the responsibilities that were getting added to my plate. And that all came to a head. And yeah, I mean, my wife kicked me out, said, you can't be here tonight. And so at that point I thought, man, everything that I had been working towards was really about like my family, right? Like I was pretty in touch with my family. I wanted to be, that's a better way to put it. I wanted to be more in touch with my family than I was. And at that moment, it just snapped into place that I had actually risked all of that and was on the verge of losing it. And that made half of the decision much easier. Like halfway was there, was like, oh, I gotta, okay, this is like, we're talking about real consequences now, right? But the other half of that was that I had been proven to myself time and time again that it was not something I could do by myself. I had tried to moderate my drinking. I had tried to, you know, keep it cool. I tried like so many times was like, ooh, that one got away from me, but I, you know, I'll learn from this and do better next time. And it was abundantly clear that I needed help. I could not do it on my own. And so when I paired those two things together, that decision came so fast that day. It's like one of those things where it's like, you know, a decision decades in the making, but in that moment was so fast and so clear.
You touched on something there that I want to kind of go back to, is that you asked for help. And I have been, you know, guilty of this. It was a struggle that I had where it was like a pride thing, right? It was like, I don't want to ask for help. Then people see me as weak. And that's something that I hear from other men, you know, whether it's shame, it's guilt, whatever. You asked for help. And I'm assuming that asking for help is something that, you know, as you've gone through these challenges, is something that you're like, hey, I need to continue doing again. Is that the case? Or was it just, you know, that one time? Or is asking for help something that's become more frequent?
Oh, it's certainly become more frequent than it was before. But easy bar to clear when I was asking for help, not at all before. You know, so just one, you know, you're like tons of infinity. But I see this in men too, but I grew up believing that asking for help was a sign of weakness. And I think everything you listed there is part of it, right? It's shame, weakness, ego. There's all of those things wrapped up in asking for help that prevents guys from doing it. That was the first kind of mantra that stuck in my mind, was asking for help is not a sign of weakness. It's actually a sign of maturity. and I should do it more often. And I do it more often now, but I mean, full disclosure, I just put on an event a couple weeks ago to raise money for cancer, and I'm like getting it set up. And usually I set all of this up on my own, and some of that is because I didn't want to like bother other people who are into town. I'm up early anyway, so and part of it is also like, you know, I like to futz around and kind of get the event settled in my mind. But this time we had like a bunch, you know, a handful of guys sitting around, and I'm 5'5", not a tall guy, and I'm like trying to hang up the sign. There's like a tall guy right there. He's like, "Hey, you could just ask for help there." I was like, "Yeah, you know what? You are right. I can ask you to just like put this sign up because I'm 5'5" and you're 6'5". Like, this is going to be easy for you, right?" So it's, you know, never perfect, but progress over perfection, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think the funny thing with asking for help, you know, I may not ask you for help. Again, going back to the whole, you know, maybe Troy's busy, you know, it's a sign of weakness. My pride won't let me, whatever. But I would be frustrated if you didn't ask me for help. So there's these two sides, you know, of asking for help. I want my friends to ask for help, but I won't allow myself to do that. Is that something you've seen as well?
Oh, 100%. It's actually one of the, you know, Simon Sinek talks about this a little bit, and it's one of the things I really like that he talks about, which is exactly what you said, right? If somebody else asked me for help, I would be thrilled and excited, and I would feel very good about being able to help. And so as he puts it, if you're not asking for help, you are, you know, you are taking or you're stealing the opportunity for your friends or loved ones to feel good by giving you a hand. You know, there's some mental judo that you have to do there. But I'm with him. Like, I mean, I feel great when I get to help people out. But yeah, then you feel like, oh, I can't ask because I don't want to inconvenience anybody or whatever else. This idea of like, I would love to help people, but I don't want to ask people for help. There's a whole part of the book dedicated to loneliness and relationships. And one of the things that I try to teach people or coach people is to call your friends, like try to call somebody every day. The amount of dopamine that you get when you hang up the phone after you talk to a friend for even like a few minutes is amazing. But what do? We like hit social media, we text, we think, oh, I don't want to bother them. Like, these are your friends. You're not going to bother them. If they called you, you'd be like, oh, sick. I get to talk to whoever, right? And so it's not just in asking for help, but it's reaching out to people in so many ways.
The powerful thing is there are so many stories that I've heard of guys that were ready to end it, right? And it was a call that was just randomly, you know, made by a friend that was the decision that stopped them from stepping over the edge. And I'm like, we never know what may seem to me as just a random call to say hello could be life-giving, you know, life-insuring as well to the person on the other line. We don't know what they're going through. So, dude, exactly what you're talking about. And right now we're seeing numbers that are huge as far as loneliness and just not being connected. So doing that is an amazingly powerful tool. Not just for the person that's getting the call, but like you talked about, for us as well, because we're getting the pleasure of talking to a friend and all the amazing chemical stuff that goes on internally.
Yeah. And so, just to highlight those numbers, right? Just to highlight those numbers about loneliness a little bit. I want to share just a couple. First one, this sounds crazy. Half of us don't have three close friends. Right. And I don't know when this will come out, but I know like Mark Zuckerberg got skewered for talking about this a little while back. because his solution to that was like, we should have AI friends. And I just want to separate those two things, because the stat about not having three close friends is real and scary. I would differ on the solution to that. So like, you know, take the friends that you have and turn them into closer friends. But that is very scary. Loneliness also has a pretty big impact on your mortality rate.
Mm-hmm.
Here are those numbers. So if you feel lonely, right, if you don't have as many connections to people as you would like to have, your mortality rate increases 26%. That's not nothing, right?
No.
Okay. If you are isolated, which means that you actually don't have a lot of connections, then it's 29%. Your mortality rate increases 29%. And if you live alone, it's 32%. So being lonely and not reaching out and isolating yourself, like, increases the chances you will die. Like, it's serious.
Yeah. And it's not just, you know, of natural causes. Like, oftentimes those emotions are what drive men to make the decision and be like, I'm done. I have nothing to offer.
Those numbers are actually boosted by people in middle age, not by old people.
Yeah. It's not something to take lightly, and it's a slippery slope to getting into it. We need to know that stuff, because a lot of times that information is not shared or discussed. It's just sweep it under the rug. You made the decision to go to rehab and to stay in rehab. And just as you're getting ready to complete it, then an unexpected diagnosis of cancer is given. Like, dude, the thought process I can only imagine there, Troy, is like, I've done the hard work, great, let's get out and have the life-changing experience, and to be hit again. For a lot of guys, that will just like leave you at a place of, I'm done, why try? I thought I was on the right path and now I'm getting hit again. Like, you're taking me out and my, you know, you're cutting out my legs from underneath me. What went on, and how did you have the resilience to then fight the cancer and, you know, move through that?
How did I do it? I mean, I put a pretty good system into place to keep myself sane. And I'm so grateful that it happened this way, right? That I went to rehab first, cancer diagnosis afterwards, because I was not equipped to deal with that situation before I went to rehab. Maybe cliche or whatever, but I shudder to think what I would have done. I mean, I know what I would have done if I got that diagnosis before rehab and I was still drinking. I mean, I just would have drank my way through it, and I don't know what kind of outcome I would have had at that point. Not as good as the outcome that I have now, I don't think. So part of what helped me get through it was sticking to the plan, sticking to what had made me successful to that point. And the sentiment that you're talking about, like, oh my gosh, how could, like, right when you're getting to the peak of the first hill, like, how do you, it's like, you know, you've heard of like false peaks when you're hiking, right? You climb up to what you think is the top and then you see, oh, actually there's like this way bigger thing afterwards. It was really that kind of moment. And my wife actually said something to me that was one of the nicest things that she's ever said. She said a lot of nice things about me. But she said, this is unfair. You just made a decision that will improve our family for generations, and now we have this. So she really felt the way that you're talking. I didn't have that feeling myself. I really just focused on the systems and focused on the routines that made me successful, because I felt like they were going to be the key to getting me through the next challenge. And they did. And they did. And that then, like, proved it twice. Like, it's worked twice. It's strong. It's strong.
So as you've gone through both, you know, rehab and then getting through cancer, what are some of the things that you put into place? You talked about having a plan.
Yeah.
Like, how are you creating the plan? You know, because we all know about goals and, you know, hey, New Year's resolutions. We know how long those stick, Troy. They don't.
Yeah.
So, like, how are you making a plan? What's involved in it? And how do you make it, you know, actually work long term beyond just, like, you know, 7 days, 14 days, 3 weeks? Yeah. How are you making it stick?
Here's the secret about rehab is that I went expecting to learn all about addiction and how it works in your brain and your body and everything else. And there was some of that, but it was the smallest portion of what I learned there. It was really treatment for being a human. And we should all go. Everybody should go. But the thing that stuck with me and then the system that I built upon it is not something new, but I guess I approached it in a way that is a little unique. So here it is. It's so simple. Nobody makes good decisions when they're hungry, angry, lonely, or tired. So it's HALT. Four letters, easy to say, easy to spell, easy to remember. When that got coached to me, I didn't like it. I didn't like it at all because it felt very reactionary. You know, the therapist basically said, hey, if you feel like you want to drink, go through this checklist. Are you hungry? Are you mad? Are you isolated? Are you exhausted? And if so, take care of that instead of going to drink. And that felt like it would take a lot of willpower. And you don't make it to rehab by having a lot of willpower. So I said, well, what if I could be more proactive about these things? Because I like, you do not make good decisions when you're hungry, angry, lonely, or tired. I believe this, and I believe this is true for everybody. So how could I be more proactive about it? If I could eat in a way where I felt nourished and satisfied and not get hangry, right? Not like, you know, skip meals and like I'm like starving. If I could process my emotions instead of stuffing them, which is a big issue for men, because we're scared of them. But then I can deal with them as they come and little by little instead of stuffing them to the point where they exploded, right? And then if I could do things like reach out to my friends, like call my friends so I'm not feeling alone or isolated. And if I could, you know, move my body a little bit, pay attention to my sleep so I have the energy to keep it all together. If I could be just more proactive about these things, then I would give myself a shot to stay sober. And it's worked so far. And it worked through a couple pretty gnarly surgeries. That was my surgeon's word, gnarly. And when a surgeon says gnarly, you know it's true. So that's the basis, right? That's the foundation. Then what are the like practical, tactical things? Okay. Every morning I do a check-in, basically. It's kind of like a checklist. It takes me 90 seconds to do. First thing I do is, how many days sober do I have? How did I sleep? I rate these on a scale of 1 to 4. You can ask me about the 4-point scale later. How did I sleep? How was my day the day before? Then what did I eat the day before for breakfast, lunch, and dinner? I'm not counting calories. I just write down like what I had. And then was it on plan or not on plan? I weigh myself. And then I, so all of that is, that's all basically 90 seconds, right? And then I have a, and then I have a journal prompt and I write in the journal. That takes longer. Everything else is about 90 seconds to do. And the journaling process, so it's that. So I check in. So I check in and those numbers then get translated into a spreadsheet because graphs tell stories that we can recognize instantly. And research shows that we are better at sticking with things if we can see it on a graph.
So it's more of being able to see what kind of trends there are and allowing it not just, to be a feeling, but facts. What importance does looking back at the day before have on how you approach today? Like, what is that a flag or an indicator for you?
So the power in all of this is, you know, hungry, angry, lonely, and tired. They don't exist in silos. All of these things affect each other and they affect us in some ways the same and some in different ways. But I can tell, like, if my eating goes down the tube, it's because there's something emotionally happening that, and so I'll see it in my eating before I even consciously recognize that something is not quite right. And so it's a way to have a canary in my emotional coal mine, basically.
Gotcha.
Right. And what I found after doing this every single day for a while is you're going to have days that are good, days that are bad, but you said the magic word before, which is trend, right? You can have like a few good days and then, you know, whatever, like things happen in our lives. Boom, awful day. But it doesn't mean that today is going to be awful. It happens all the time. The numbers bounce up and down and up and down, but the trend has gotten better for a while. And so that's kind of one of the benefits about doing it every day is you realize that the data point doesn't matter as much. So just write it down. And this to me especially was helpful in losing weight. I mean, I lost more than 50 pounds doing this. And sometimes I could eat the same thing, do the same workout, do like in my mind, do everything exactly the same. And one morning I would get on the scale and it would have one number. And the next day it could even go up. And I would say like, I did everything right. I did everything right. How do I weigh more today than, you know, because our bodies just fluctuate weight a little bit. And so initially when I started, I got pretty bunchy about those things, you know, like I was like, oh my God, like I wanted to, but progress is not linear, right? And so, you know, if you look at the graph at my weight, it goes ping, 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 but sloping down over a while. And then now has stayed steady for a while now. But yeah, you recognize that the one data point doesn't change everything.
Right. Yeah. You know, and that's crucial. I think the way you've set that up is almost like an early warning system, right? Rather than saying, hey, I've slid back, you know, 15 feet. You're like, whoa, okay, wait, we did like 2 feet backwards. Okay, what's going on? So it's alerting you because you're aware of what's going on. And I think you talking about like the weight loss is so important because one point doesn't tell the full picture, right? It doesn't say like, hey, yeah, you've been going to the gym and working out and your muscles are getting, you know, bigger, or, you know, hey, you've dropped so many inches in this part of your body. It's not telling you your energy levels. Like, it's just like you said, one point that tells you a certain picture, but it's collectively, like when you're listing all those points that you're tracking, it's like that may just be an off little blip and it's like, okay, but it's bringing you awareness, which I think is so crucial. You had talked about having 4 points in kind of how you're looking at stuff. Can you share a little bit on that of what they are and how you're using them?
Dude, the 4-point scale is amazing. It's so good. I like the 4-point scale because it kind of makes you pick a side. There's no middle, right? You have 1, 2 on the maybe not so good side, and then you have 3 or 4. So it kind of dispenses with the Midwestern politeness of the 7 out of 10 or the 3 out of 5. And so if it's, you know, if it's meals, for example, right? 4, super clean, on plan, right? Exactly what I wanted to be doing. 1 is I ate like a garbage person. Now, most things are going to fall between those, right? Where you're like, you know, yeah, pretty good. I'm like, pretty good. That's, or you're like, you know, it wasn't super trashy, but I wasn't great. I wasn't great there. And so I like the 4-point scale for that. If it's about kind of my mood or how was yesterday, right? It was like, like best day ever. Like would I want to repeat that day? 4 is like, absolutely. 3 is like, yeah, I'd have that day again. 2 is like, you know, I lived through it, but it wasn't the best. And then 1 is just like, I would love to never have that day again. And we all have those days, is the point, yes. Right? The other fun thing that this system allows you to do is like come back at the end of the year or the end of the month or whenever and say like, how many amazing days did I have and how many awful days did I have? Then you can go back, because it's in a spreadsheet. You can filter by the best days. Kind of see what you were doing that day. And when you talk about New Year's resolutions, you can use that as a way to come up with some of those. Because if you're not looking back and kind of saying like, what were the common threads in my best days? And then thinking about how you can structurally put more of those days into your life, it makes it harder. You're more of a susceptible to the whims that you're feeling that day, I suppose. Because it's easy to forget what happened in February when you're writing this in January, when you're coming up with your New Year's resolutions. February is too far back, right? But if you have a place to go look at it and see how you're feeling in the moment, not just how you remember it, because our memories are, you know, not amazing all the time, I think is a polite way to put it, but it helps. It's a good process for me.
So Troy, you mentioned one of the markers that you're looking at is sleep. And for many of us as men, sleep is sacrificed to be honest, right?
Yeah.
We've got all these things we're trying to do in the day, finally roll into bed, roll out of bed exhausted, think we're going to catch up on the weekend.
Yeah.
And then we're trying to cope, you know, medicate. We're trying to like decompress on the weekend so we don't get that sleep that we, you know, missed out during the week. What kind of factor, or like, what is the importance of sleep in, you know, having a great day? How does that, you know, help us to elevate our day, or, you know, take us down the hill and, you know, just, yeah, take us towards a crash course?
I mean, sleeping is massively important to everything that we do. If you think about it biologically, for example, if you sleep less than 7 hours, you are more likely to eat 500 extra calories during the day. Mm-hmm. Because your body is tired, and your body gets energy in two ways. It sleeps or it eats. And so if you're not sleeping, you're probably overeating. Then you're worried about or thinking about, why can't I lose weight if you need to lose weight? And part of that could be because you're not sleeping enough. Big part of it, right? It's good for your emotional regulation, your cognitive abilities, your decision-making decreases. And people wear not sleeping a lot like a badge of honor. I did for a very long time. And they believe that they can do just as well on 5 hours of sleep as they do on 7 or 8. And that is scientifically not true. And in fact, studies show that the people who believe that the most are the worst. They have the worst gap between it, but they have an overconfidence. So believing that you can function on 5 hours of sleep is like not believing in gravity. But I promise you're wearing a parachute when you jump out of the plane.
Yeah. No, I'm guilty of that. I'll step onto the boat, be the captain. For over a decade, I was sleeping 4 hours a night and just thought, hey, I'll be okay. Nothing could be further from the truth. I'm reclaiming my health because of that decision and the actions I took in just sacrificing, laying my sleep aside. So it definitely plays an importance in how we show up then, and then, you know, how our body is down the road. So
yeah,
it's something that I like to encourage guys, stop, invest in yourself. And, you know, that is one thing, you know, self-care at a core is sleeping, which we just kind of toss it. It's like tossed out the window first thing, you know, but it's something we should be holding on to with all our might to make sure that we're being the best we can. So
what is, if you gave somebody one thing, what did you do to fix your sleep?
I am still in the process of fixing it.
Fair.
So setting a time to go to sleep and setting a time to wake up, getting light out of the bedroom, and then, you know, getting up in the middle of the night, I did not look at the alarm clock. I used to be so guilty of that. And then it was like, oh, I should be awake. I should be rolling. Man, there's so many myths we buy into to support our lives. But yeah, those are a couple things. I'm still working on it, honestly, Troy, just because, you know, after over a decade, your body gets into habits and you start to experience things. But the funny thing is, as I begin to feel like I'm sleeping better and better, I'm then finding out how much I thought better and better was still short, and that I have more to go to actually sleep well. And so it's, I don't know, it's still an awakening and realization process, if that makes sense. But it was something that, Troy, I neglected, intentionally neglected, you know, for a long period of time. And there is nothing like waking up and feeling alert and vibrant and clear-headed. And I know that there is, again, still more to come.
Yeah.
But don't allow yourself to get to that point. And I love that the markers, that is an indicator on there of, hey, did you sleep really well? Did you sleep really poorly? And I have a feeling, like you talked about, you'll start seeing that. And if you're sleeping 7 days a week poorly, that's over 1 day's worth of extra calories is what you're talking about there, right?
Yeah.
So 3,500 calories. It's like, dang. So yeah. Well, Troy, dude, I want to make sure you have given us some definite stuff to think about and encouraged us in, like, hey man, it just because you make the right decisions doesn't mean the future is going to shine kindly on you. Or like your wife talked about, you know, it doesn't remove like the unfairness of things that can come along. So I want to make sure guys can connect with you outside of the podcast. What's the best way to reach you, to find out more, to get your book and just plug into what you're sharing with men?
Yeah, I appreciate that. Easiest way is to just go to my website. Right on the homepage, you can drop your email in there. And I send out one email a week, and it usually has I want to say it's a good story. I always think they're good stories, whatever, you know, but it's but stories that then have some kind of value. You know, it's not a place where I sell very often, if ever. Usually just stories from my life that feed into something bigger or a bigger idea that has helped me keep this transformation that I've gone through. So that's the easiest way. Go to my website. It's troykarnes.com, and drop your email in, and I'll send you a note. Easy to connect.
Awesome. Troy, I appreciate it. Thank you very much. I'll have that in the show notes. So if any guys are driving down the road, Just come back, revisit it. You don't have to try and click the link and everything. We'll make it really easy for you to get with Troy. So
yeah.
Troy,
yeah,
thank you again, my friend.
Oh, Mike, I appreciate this space. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks so much, my friend, for joining me on another episode. If you found the information within the show helpful, please leave a review on the platform you're listening to. It helps raise the show's visibility so other men can join us in breaking free. See you on the next episode, and remember to continue putting yourself out there. Have a great one.